I think you probably all know Abaya very well. He's, after all, been with us, with the order, in the order, a very long time. He was one of the first people who I spotted, as it were, when I came into contact with the movement. And probably some of you have seen Surya Prabha's film, in which Abaya is seen walking down a kerfold with Banti on one side, and there's a little puff of smoke coming up above them. I think Abaya is smoking. He doesn't smoke any longer. Not in that way, anyway. But I've known Abaya a very long time, and I regard him as a very, very dear friend. I'm fortunate enough to share a community with him at the moment, and it's a real delight because not only is he a wonderful man, he's a very good cook and an excellent gardener. I'm very glad not to have to pay too much attention to the garden because Abaya does it. But he's such a lovely and positive influence. He's always positive. He's often wise and good-humoured. He's very learned as well, and he's a delightful man. So here he is, Abaya talking about his.
Thank you very much, Ashwajit. As you, most of you probably know, I spent some time in Tokyo, in Japan. I spent 4 years there. And I experienced in my first year there a very strange and enjoyable natural phenomenon. And it's what's known in Tokyo as spring wind. The winters in Japan are very much like the winters in this country, or like the winters in this country used to be before the climate change took over. They're quite cold and they seem to go on and on. But then one morning, my first winter in Tokyo, one afternoon rather, I went into the street and I experienced the blowing of this beautiful breeze. It just seemed to spring from nowhere suddenly, like a wonderful breeze that it was warm and quite strong, and it seemed to blow away the winter wind and everything for, you know, at least for half an hour, yeah, before the winter came back again. So this reminded me of very much, it seems to me, a suitable image for the eruption of the transcendental into one's samsaric existence. The first eruption of the Dharma into one's life is a bit like a very beautiful fresh breeze. There are three phases to this talk, actually, and I've just introduced the first phase. The first phase of my motivation for practicing the Dharma was based on this eruption of the transcendental into my life. My first real taste of the Dharma, it was so powerful, because it was so unusual and in a way so unexpected, that it kept me going. It kept me practicing for a long time. It took me through the first phase of my practice of the Dharma, my motivation. It provided my motivation for practice. In the early days, well, not very early days, but in the early 80s, we used to study, Bhante used to lead seminars on a text called The Jewel Ornament of Liberation, which is a Kagyupa, Tibetan text, supposedly written by Gampopa. And it seems to have, I might be wrong here, but it seems to have fallen out of fashion, studying this text. But the first chapter of the text, The Jewel Ornament of Liberation, the alternative title, by the way, is The Wish-Fulfilling Gem of the Noble Doctrine. Rather beautiful. the wish-fulfilling gem of the Noble Doctrine. The first chapter is the motive. It's called the motive. You can't practice without the motive. And the motive is the driving force. The motive is what moves you. If something doesn't move you, then you're not going to be able to make any progress. And in that chapter, the motive is Tathagata Garbha. Oh dear, we're already on dangerous, tricky ground, yeah? The Tathagata Garbha. But anyway, I interpret that as the presence of the Dharma, the transcendental, in one's life. Of course, there is the danger of thinking that you are already a Buddha. We've all been into that, particularly recently. But there is also the danger of thinking that the transcendental, the Dharma in its transcendental sense, has nothing to do with you. So one of the images that is used is in that text and in other texts is that in order for the butter to arise, you have to churn the milk. Yeah? But it's ridiculous to think that the butter is already present in the milk, because if it were, then the milkman would be able to charge you for butter as well as for milk. But it isn't there. You've got to churn it. But at the same time, there is a connection between the two. There is an intimate connection between the two. Otherwise, when you churned milk, the result would be jam, perhaps. The result is always milk. Sorry. The result is always butter. In The Awakening of Faith, which is another famous Mahayana text, there's this idea of the mutual perfuming of the mundane and the transcendental. I've always liked that. There's a perfume, a trace of the transcendental in the samsara, in the mundane. And if there weren't, we wouldn't be able to make any progress. So in the early days, I've been practicing for nearly 40 years now, in the early days, I don't think it was just me, we were out for the big insight, capital B, capital I, the big flash. Yeah? I think it was partly to do with the popularity of Zen at the time. I remember going to a sesshin, which was led by Ju Kennet Roshi, a woman who formed the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives, which in this country functions from Throstle Ho Priory. And as soon as I arrived at that sesshin, you always have a personal interview with the master. And she said to me, I was 2 days late, I don't know why I didn't go at the beginning, but she said, we've already had two Kensho's. Kensho is not quite the same as good as Satori, but it's a bit of a breakthrough, a bit of a flash, yeah? So they'd already had two. So, you know, we geared up, and you sit on your cushion, and you really sort of, you know, you go for that flash, go for that insight. So I think one aspect, although we might have gone a bit over the top in looking for the big flash, the insight for ourselves alone, it was very selfish. It was very sort of Hinayana as opposed to Mahayana. Nevertheless, there was something very, very strong and beautiful about those early experiences. And there was something about them that never left us. And there was also about them that feeling that really one has all one needs. It's not as if enlightenment is going to come from out there somewhere, or that you've got to be a bit more educated and get some quality that you don't already have. You've got absolutely everything. We have got everything we need to work with. And, of course, we've got to start churning the milk. That was the first phase. I just wanted to tell you that was the first phase of my motivation for practicing the Dharma. This desire, this craving even, it was a craving. It was a craving to get that experience. And we almost like took Bantik, well, I can't say by the lapels because he used to wear a robe in those days, but it's almost like, you know, you get him by the robe and say, please give me this experience, which you obviously have had. I may be just talking about myself here, but I think there was very much that kind of attitude. And of course, Bante had his reservations about this kind of attitude. And he started teaching us in the way which was much more suitable for the stage we were at. So that brings me now to the second phase of motivation for practicing the Dharma. And I've entitled this in my notes, "The motive comes from the practice itself." It means one begins sooner or later, and in terms of following Bhante's teaching, it was sooner rather than later, we begin to experience the results of practice. I was very inspired in the late 60s, early 70s, by Bhante's exposition of the two kinds of conditionality. The text, this text I've talked about, the Dual Ornament of Liberation, says, the first sentence is, that the whole of reality is subsumed under samsara and nirvana. The whole of reality is subsumed by this duality of samsara and nirvana. And of course, these are the two modes of conditioning, the reactive mode of conditioning and the positive mode of conditioning. And Bhante unfolded this teaching in a wonderful lecture, I think it is. It's a seminal lecture called Mind Reactive and Creative. And that lecture had a very, very powerful driving force on our practice in the early days. It provided, for me certainly, a very strong motivation. And I was especially inspired by his remark that one has the choice, not just every week, not just every day, but every single moment one has the choice of taking those two paths, either into the reactive mode or the creative mode, every single moment of one's life. And that really sort of turned me on. But also, the context was very much in terms of spiritual friendship. The third chapter of the text is called Meeting Spiritual Friends. And that chapter goes into great detail of how important it is to have spiritual friends. Meeting in the sense of being inspired by one's Kalyana Mitras, inspired and taught by one's guru, one's teacher, one's preceptors, and so on. So what was happening in the early days of the movement was the beginning of the fashioning of this web of interconnectedness, of this web of spiritual friendship, which I think is a vital practice in the movement we belong to, in the order we belong to. And I think it's one of the great things about our practice, this practice of spiritual friendship. The fashion these days is very much to talk in terms of meditation. And we put a lot of energy into meditation, which is very, very good. And we practice meditation, and we're developing new skills and new methods of approach to the teaching of meditation. But I feel we must not neglect the other practices. Meditation isn't the total practice. There's ethics and there's spiritual community. There is our interaction with one another, our interconnectedness. And I think we've worked extremely well on that. Take, for example, chapter meetings. At the chapter meeting last week, I suddenly felt impelled to rejoice in the existence of chapter meetings. I just felt like rejoicing in the fact that we've keep going to chapter meetings, or at least I hope most order members do. And I worked it out very briefly, very quickly, that I must have been, there were 4 years when I was in Tokyo, I didn't go to chapter meetings, but I must have been to easily over 1,000 chapter meetings. That's 3,000 hours I've sat about with a group of order members, and we've been confessing to each other. We've been intimate with each other. We've had rows with each other. We've sorted out difficulties. And although it's been I don't sort of feel on the morning of chapter meeting, oh gosh, it's chapter meeting tonight. I've never felt that. But I keep going. So what's my motivation? My motivation is I've experienced the benefits of spiritual friendship within that context, and I see the importance of it, and I feel it. I don't feel it in that excited woo-woo sense, but I feel it deep down as part of my being that, we're getting together, we're practicing. And the text says, since at the beginning of one's spiritual career, it is impossible to be in touch with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas on a higher level of spirituality, we have to meet with ordinary human beings as spiritual friends. Well, that's my second phase of motivation. The motivation I've got through practicing, and not just meditation, but through practicing mind creative, especially in the context of spiritual friendship. Well, I'm sorry, but I have to admit that things got really difficult, and that I went into a period of dry. In the late 80s, early 90s, I felt that there was no oil left in the engine, and the cogs were just grinding together, and I entered a kind of spiritual crisis. And I got to the stage, I won't go into any details, but I got to the stage of thinking, well, shall I give it all up? It was also a bit of a midlife crisis, and I've noticed that, it was a combination of natural midlife crisis and spiritual crisis as a result of having practiced for 20 years and not gained enlightenment, or not just not gained enlightenment, but not actually made the progress that I would like to have made within 20 years. I felt, what have I got to show for it? 20 years! I've been to all the chapter meetings, over 1,000 chapter meetings. What have I got to show for it? It's a bit like that, isn't it? Men, women in their early 50s, they look back on their career. I've been a teacher for 30 years. I've been in business for 40 years. What have I got to show for it? And you take stock, and you review your whole life, and you wonder what the heck's going on, and shall you give it all up? So anyway, I went through something like that. It was pretty big and pretty painful, and I escaped. I escaped to Japan. Yeah, I wasn't going to go to Japan, but interestingly enough, circumstances led me there. So in 1991, I found myself in Tokyo, Japan, having got away from the FWBO and got away from wearing all these hats, and being kind to Mitras and things like that. I didn't want to be an uncle to Mitras anymore. Anyway, so I went then into the third phase of motivation. And I've entitled this, the motivation third, the motivation comes from mainly from the level of the archetypal. Not that the archetypal had not been present for the previous 20 years. I'd had substantial contact with the archetypal through practicing sadhana for a long time. I'd always had a lot of interest in the arts, especially literature, and I had a very eventful and sometimes dramatic dream life. So I was in contact with the archetypal level of reality. The Rupa Loka was very important to me. But in this last phase, for some reason, the archetypal seemed to come to the fore, just quite sort of naturally. And I found myself in Japan, and Japan happens to be, although I didn't go for that reason, Japan happens to have been at one stage a Buddhist country. And Buddhism is practiced in Japan. And there is a lot of cultural, beautiful stuff in Japan. Sorry, that's not the right word, but a lot of iconography, loads of temples, and you're surrounded by it, in a way. If you know where to look for it, you don't have to go far, but you come into contact with very beautiful, very powerful Buddhist iconography. And one aspect of that iconography that got through to me straight away was gigantic figures. You go into temples, and at the temple gates, either side of the gate, there are these huge protectors, fierce-eyed and fanged mouths, and with these terrible implements, you know. I mean, not just a little vajra, but a huge sort of vajra that, you know, sort of saying to you, if you're coming into this temple with any negative emotion, you better watch out. Yes, I felt protected, and I felt I needed protection, because there were demons in this spiritual crisis I'd been through. The demons were getting at me. There were lots of demons. So these protectors were very, very big, and they forced themselves on my consciousness. And I remember I had a picture of one on my wall in my little flat in Tokyo. It was of they're usually not young men, they're middle-aged men, they're elderly men, about the age I was then, which was appropriate. And they're stripped to the waist, and they're quite sinewy but strong, and they're really mean business. And I had him on my wall, and he protected me. I like to think, and I think it's true, he protected me. And you go to a great temple like the Toji Temple in Kyoto, and in one of the display halls in Tokyo, in Toji Temple, there is the mandala of the five Buddhas, very, very beautiful sculptures, just all arranged on this huge platform. And there are attendant bodhisattvas, and attendant deities, all carved beautifully in wood. The Japanese are wonderful wood carvers. But at the four corners, there are the four great kings. And the four great kings are huge protectors, figures, and they protect the mandala. So I saw a lot of sets of the four great kings, and lots of these gigantic images. But I want to tell you about one particular gigantic image that is more important to me than all the rest. About the fourth week I was in Tokyo, Bodhananda, who was also there at the time, he took me with some of his students to Kamakura. You've heard of Kamakura. Kamakura used to be the capital of Tokyo, and there are of Japan, and there are lots of temples in Kamakura. But the first place we went to see the giant Buddha, the Daibutsu, the giant Buddha of Kamakura. We went into the temple precincts, and I'd seen pictures of it before, so I sort of knew what to expect. I walked into the courtyard and there he was, and it was a most magnificent experience to see the giant Buddha of Kamakura sitting there. He must be three times life size, cast in bronze, rather stern looking, not smiling, in meditation mudra, quite stern, but very, very commanding, with all these little human beings walking around him. And of course it's Amitabha, or as the Japanese call him, Amida Buddha. And Amida is the Buddha of the Pure Land, the Buddha of the East. But for me, and I went back to Kamakura many, many times to imbibe the influence of the giant Buddha, the giant Buddha of Kamakura for me, although he was Amitabha, what the aspect of him that I really responded to was Akshobhya. Akshobhya. He was unshakable. That was the aspect that really got to me and that I responded to archetypally. This Buddha was cast in the Middle Ages, and originally there was a temple. And round about the end of the 13th century, there was this huge earthquake, and the earthquake caused this amazing tsunami. And the tsunami just swept right through the village, and it just swept the temple away. But the Buddha just sat there, absolutely imperturbable, unshakable. And this really got through to me. And I suppose how I responded to it in my small way as I stood in front of him was that, yes, the Dharma, the Buddha in my heart, is really unshakable. No matter what happens, you know, how difficult things can be, the Buddha has somehow implanted, the Dharma is implanted into my life. And I can play at going back to samsara. I did play at going back to samsara in Tokyo sometime, not with a vengeance, but I really did my best, you know, to get into consumerism and, you know, doing what I wanted to. But it was, as Ashwajit intimated, it was just unsatisfactory. I knew that I would never be satisfied by anything that did not include the Dharma. Well, I think I've packed quite a lot into a short time, so I'm going to allow myself another couple of minutes to just finish off. What I've been saying is that the motivation in the third phase of my Dharma life has been contact with the archetypal. Not that one stops making an effort, one has to continue making an effort all the time. But having made that effort, I feel protected. Yes, I feel much more protected. And I feel I can surrender to these great protectors, these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So you could say, I think, that the first phase of my Dharma existence was the path of self-discovery. The Buddha within, as it were, and wanting this experience. Then the second phase of my Dharma practice was definitely the path of self-development, of having to put a lot of effort into doing what had to be done in order that the milk could be churned and become butter. And then the third phase, not completely, but there was this element of self-surrender, which is interesting because although the great Buddha of Kamakura, it's his unshakability that appealed to me. He is, after all, the Buddha of the Pure Land, and the essence of Pure Land practice is to surrender. Surrender completely to the Buddha outside you, just to give yourself completely. And I think I've found that much more in the last few years, that yes, one has to make an effort and one has to keep trying. But in a way, one can't stop doing that because one realizes the importance of it. And then having tried, having put in the effort, then one simply surrenders. And that's a wonderful feeling, that you surrender to forces that are still very much outside oneself and greater than oneself. I think that's helpful.